From NPR and WBUR, I'm Don Gagne.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Biden said today that he supports the Cuban people who took to the streets yesterday in the biggest protest the country has seen in decades. Protesters chanting Libertad, or freedom, signaled they are fed up with the repressive communist government and its handling of the economy. Joining us now is Jose Miguel Vivanco. He's director of the Americas Division at Human Rights Watch. Jose, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So as far as you can tell, what is driving these protests? What's behind them?
The economic conditions, shortages of food, medicine, the pandemic is obviously having an important role here, and lack of access to consistent access to electricity and repression in general, lack of freedom and police brutality, you know, recent action against artists and intellectuals and independent journalists by the government is obviously having an impact as well.
And why do you think all of those factors are coming to a head right now and boiling over?
Look, it's hard to say, but my sense is that the Cuban people is pretty fed up with the lack of progress, improvement in terms of economic and social conditions. And the fact that there is no a Castro, either Fidel or Raúl Castro, in charge. The current one, Díaz-Canel, is not very well known in Cuba. And I don't think he has the gravitas or the credibility to address these issues in Cuba.
Hmm. Cuba, not exactly known for its mass protests, is it? So how rare are demonstrations of this scale?
Unprecedented. We haven't seen something like this ever, actually, in Cuba, because this is not concentrated only in La Habana, in the capital. There are many Cuban provinces, important cities, that experience are experiencing this type of demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations. So this is actually the first time that something of this sort happened in Cuba.
Hmm. And one of your jobs at Human Rights Watch is to track how the government is responding to protests like this. What are you seeing in terms of government response and police response?
Unfortunately, the current government is resorting to brutality. There are complaints about massive arbitrary arrest, as well as people wounded, and they are going after senior citizens, kids, women, without discriminating. And this is actually a very, very fluid situation that could end up in something actually very, very serious.
Hmm. There have been some liberalizations in Cuba over the past few years that have been important. So, for instance, more Cubans have mobile phones now with access to the internet in social media. We've seen that play a major role in uprisings and protests across the world in recent years. What kind of role do you think that has played here?
Social media has played a fundamental role in Cuba, I would say, during the last 2 to 3 years. Cubans are using Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, extensively across the island. And it helps them to connect it with the rest of the world, of course, to organize themselves and to use YouTube, for instance, to make these abuses that are ongoing on daily basis in Cuba visible for themselves as well as for the rest of the world.
Hmm. I wonder if the government is somehow regretting its decision to liberalize there on that front.
I mean, they have mixed feelings about this. And yesterday, for instance, they cut off internet completely for a couple of hours for the entire island. And then they reestablished access to internet, but selectively. They realized that if they cut off internet for the island, that might provoke segment of Cuban society who are not part of these demonstrations will probably join the demonstrations. So what they are trying to do is selectively isolate some locations or individuals who they know that are connected with these peaceful demonstrations.
Well, we do see that there are some supporters of the government that did rally on the streets over the weekend, and the BBC is reporting that there were clashes between those two groups. As these tensions continue, what are you watching for?
It's really, really critical that some democratic governments, those ones who might have some influence in Cuba, I'm thinking about the socialist government in Spain, for instance, or the socialist government in Mexico, they should stand up and send crystal clear messages to the Cuban regime, the Cuban government, that they have to respect the universal right of peaceful demonstrations.
Jose Miguel Vivanco is director of the Americas Division of Human Rights Watch. He's watching these rare protests unfold in Cuba. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Debates about defunding the police and what that even means are taking place in cities across the country, including in Kansas City, Missouri. That's where Democratic Mayor Quentin Lucas recently pushed a plan through the city council that will reallocate part of the police budget towards social programs that fight crime. Advocates of police reform are applauding him, but critics are accusing him of, quote, defunding the police, as Peggy Lowe of member station KCUR reports.
On a rainy night in North Kansas City last month, a dozen people are on the sidewalk outside a shopping center holding handmade signs that say, "Back the Blue" and "Pray for our police."
Blessed be God and His angels and saints.
The group is called the American Society for the Defense of Traditional Family and Property. It's a national Catholic group led locally by a Topeka man, Francis Slobodnik. He says if there were no police, society would be survival of the fittest.
Police, law enforcement, protect everyone's lives, make us all safe. I sleep soundly in my bed at night. You do too, because there's somebody who isn't sleeping at night.
Slobodnik's group was outside an angry town hall meeting organized by North Kansas City Council members and state lawmakers who are furious about Lucas's plan. It would reallocate about $42 million toward work on violence prevention and better public safety, roughly a fifth of the entire police budget. But that's not how many see it, including Greg Mills, a Northland resident who spoke at the meeting.
Reallocation versus defunding. We hear that, and you can put all the lipstick you want on the defunding pig, but it is defunding.
And what's happening in Kansas City, this is much in line with reallocating, and the mayor actually used those specific words.
Rashawn Ray is a professor of sociology and the executive director of the Lab for Applied Social Science Research at the University of Maryland. He's watched this debate in several cities and says many people are unaware that police budgets have grown over the last 30 to 40 years, thanks often to the power of the police unions, and they can eat up to a quarter of the city's budget. He says that tilts the power in one direction, toward law enforcement.
One of the things that the mayor and the city council, at least the majority of them, are also aiming to do is to shift accountability, to shift power, and then to also shift funding within police department budgets. That's different from simply removing funding from law enforcement.
Dan Fowler is a city councilman from North Kansas City. He had to stop the town hall meeting in late May twice to calm the mostly white crowd of hundreds who were furious with Mayor Lucas, who is black. Fowler's opposed to Lucas's plan, in part because he says he hasn't seen any crime prevention programs that work. He also says he doesn't have a rebuttal to his constituents' claim that the plan defunds the police. Yet he allows that it could be, in his words, a possible representation.
I think there is room in there that there could be a reduction in the amount of funding the police get based upon the strict language of the ordinance. Do I really think we'll get a reduction? Probably not.
Missouri law says the city must spend 20% of its revenues on police. Last year, it spent over 25%. Lucas's plan keeps the police budget at the required 20%, and that extra funding goes into the Prevention and Community Services Fund. The mayor and city council will negotiate with the police department on how that will be spent. The first time city leaders would have a say in police funding in over 80 years. There's also an additional $3 million for a new police academy class. The Kansas City Board of Police Commissioners, appointed by the Missouri governor, is suing the mayor and council.
This is a lawsuit filed about power.
Mayor Lucas and the city are fighting the Board of Police Commissioners lawsuit, which they characterize as keeping power out of the hands of local officials.
It reflects nothing about standing up for law enforcement. This is not a lawsuit about our rank and file officers. This is not a lawsuit to support them. This is not a lawsuit to address public safety.
The plan is now on hold pending that lawsuit. Hearings are expected in Jackson County District Court this summer. For Here and Now, I'm Peggy Ray.
More than 37 million adults in this country suffer from some form of hearing loss, and yet many of them don't use hearing aids. Cost is one big reason why. Hearing aids are expensive and often aren't covered by insurance or Medicare. Now, President Biden's new sweeping executive order on competition is trying to make it easier for hearing aids to be sold over the counter at pharmacies. Advocates hope that will make them more accessible and drive prices down. Let's bring in Megan Reed. She is Director of Clinical Audiology at Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Megan, welcome.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
And do you think President Biden's order will help?
I absolutely think it will help. This goes back to the 2017 Over-the-Counter Hearing Aid Act, and I think it's something that Biden's support and reinforcement will hopefully speed up. There's been delays in passing the requirements through the FDA, and I think the support from Biden is just going to help it move even faster.
So the president's order might speed it up, but a typical pair of hearing aids can cost nearly $5,000 on average. Why are they so expensive, and why doesn't insurance cover them?
Hearing aids are expensive, but what most people don't understand is that a large portion of the cost of hearing aids includes the services of the audiologist or the hearing instrument specialist who is fitting and dispensing and supporting the care of that patient and those products over the life of those hearing aids. More and more insurances are beginning to cover devices, but they do follow Medicare's. Most insurances follow Medicare's guidelines in terms of coverage for services and devices, and Medicare, unfortunately, does not cover the cost of hearing aids or, at this time, the services to support those devices. Medicare cites that they are not covering age-related type of diseases, and hearing loss is oftentimes associated with age-related type of deterioration.
What are the potential benefits, then, and the risks of selling hearing aids over the counter?
I think the clear benefit is better access. There's over 37 million people who have hearing loss in America, and a very, very small percentage of patients actually pursue devices to help them hear better and help them communicate better. Individuals who have hearing loss are often subject to isolation, and it impacts so many other areas of their life. There's some correlation with concerns of dementia or other cognitive delays. And so if we can provide better access to individuals who have hearing difficulties, I think over-the-counter devices are just going to be able to create a better opportunity for many people out there.
How much has the technology changed in recent years?
Hearing aids that the FDA considers medically defined devices, the biggest changes are trying to improve understanding and background noise, which is where a lot of individuals, especially individuals who have more of a mild to moderate hearing loss, who these over-the-counter devices are aimed at, try to help improve how they hear in complicated listening and situations. And the manufacturers have been focusing on trying to improve how they work in those environments. We also look at hearables or personal sound amplifiers, which are currently an unregulated class of commercial devices that are improving and becoming closer and closer to medically defined hearing aids. Bose has had for a number of years a personal sound amplifier, and they just recently this year released a self-fit hearing aid. They were the first manufacturer that the FDA approved a self-fitting hearing aid, which I think in a lot of ways, once the over-the-counter hearing aids are defined, their technology will probably quickly fall into, I expect, the definition of what an over-the-counter hearing aid is.
So cost is one reason that people are not getting the hearing aids that they need for their lives. Stigma is also another one, for whatever reason. And I want you to talk just briefly, before I let you go, about that. How we get over the fact that people still feel stigmatized for needing help with hearing.
Yes. I think the stigma associated with hearing aids is that they might make people feel old. And I think the stigma partially is getting more people who can have these devices and have easier access at a younger age. Hearing loss is occurring younger and younger. And if younger people who maybe feel like they wouldn't be pursuing hearing aids if they had to go through a medical professional or had to pay the high cost of hearing aids out of pocket were pursuing these devices, I think that would help address stigma. But I also think that these over-the-counter manufacturers that we're talking about are going to pursue different form factors that may not look like a conventional hearing aid. Apple earbuds are an example of devices that have features very similar to hearing aids, but look just like earphones do at this point in time. So I think as the market opens and more manufacturers are part of the development of devices and hearing solutions, that we are going to find different form factors that will make people feel more comfortable with these, with trying to hear better.
Megan Reed is Director of Clinical Audiology at Mass Eye and Ear. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
In South Korea, the government is imposing the highest level yet of social distancing restrictions in the capital of Seoul to try to stop a rapid rise in the number of cases of COVID-19. The increase in cases is worrying because only about 11% of the country's 52 million people are fully vaccinated. Let's check in with NPR's Seoul correspondent, Anthony Kuhn. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Don.
So let's start with what you're seeing in Seoul. Describe these tighter restrictions that are now in place there and in the surrounding regions as well.
Yeah, they're the tightest the country has had since the pandemic started because the case numbers are the highest they've ever had. It might not sound a lot by international standards. We're talking a high of about 1,300 cases a day, but they're still rising, and experts say the peak of this wave could be double what we're seeing now. There are no gatherings of more than two people allowed after 6 p.m., no more than four during the daytime. All night spots in the capital region, including bars, clubs, karaoke parlors, are all shut down. And then they get into some micromanagement. For example, gym treadmills can go no faster than 3.7 miles an hour or six kilometers an hour. And spinning, aerobics, dance classes, all has to be to music whose speed is no faster than 120 beats per minute.
Wow. And how are South Koreans reacting to the return, actually, of these really strict measures?
Well, I think they're particularly dismayed because it goes against what they were expecting. They were expecting looser restrictions. Case numbers have been stable around 500, 700 or so for the past couple of months. And while those were not as low as authorities had hoped to get them, they seemed manageable. So authorities had planned to ease up restrictions both to help the economy and also they had measures to incentivize, to motivate people to get vaccinated, such as saying that fully vaccinated people could go without masks outdoors. And it's a sort of a tough situation for the government to describe. They say on the one hand, this could hopefully be the last hurdle before they hit 70% immunization rate. But they also admit it's the biggest crisis the nation has faced so far in the pandemic.
And if COVID-19 cases there have been on the rise for about 3 weeks or so, is it being driven, as is the case elsewhere, by variants?
Not so much. More than a quarter in the capital region are now Delta variant cases. But mostly the surge is being driven by the Seoul region, which accounted for 80% of the cases, but that's now declining as infections spread. And the surge is also being driven by people mostly in their 20s and 30s who are socially active. And these are mostly chance encounters in small unventilated areas, authorities say. They're small clusters that are so widespread, it's very hard for authorities to get out in front of them and isolate them. Before, you had clusters centered on churches or on certain cities, and they could isolate them, but now they're just too widespread.
And what kind of progress has the government actually been able to make in vaccinating South Koreans?
It's a little bit slow. They've had they've gotten about 30% of South Koreans vaccinated with one dose, but less than 12% fully vaccinated. And that now is even lower than neighboring Japan. Authorities were supposed to start taking reservations this week, actually, to vaccinate people in their 50s within the month. But they had to suspend that because they're running low on vaccine supplies.
Last week, Israel shipped 700,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine to South Korea in an exchange. And South Korea has promised to supply the same number of doses to Israel later on this year. So there's this trade deal going on. Is South Korea pursuing other deals like this to get more vaccines into the country?
They had hoped to do a swap with the U.S., but that didn't work out. The U.S. did promise to provide vaccinations for South Korea's military because a lot of them work with U.S. troops. As it turns out, they did their first swap deal with Israel, but it has problems because, first of all the doses expire at the end of this month, and also because the Palestinians had just turned down such an offer from Israel. So authorities had to scramble to reassure that this was not the batch that the Palestinians turned down. And also that South Korea will be able to administer all these doses that they receive from Israel before they expire.
NPR's Seoul correspondent, Anthony Kuhn. Anthony, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Don.
The economy is changing so fast right now, and sometimes it seems like there's something new to worry about every day. On The Indicator from Planet Money, we bring you human stories and easy-to-understand explanations to help you make sense of these crazy times, all in just 10 minutes a day. That's The Indicator from Planet Money.
The 38th annual Sun Valley Conference has ended. This is the so-called summer camp for billionaires. The exclusive conference, convened by the investment bank Allen & Company in Sun Valley, Idaho, is known for the CEOs and wealthy movers and shakers who attend, and the deals they make in backroom conversations. NPR's David Gura was in Sun Valley, and he joins us to talk about it. Hi, David.
Hey, Don. Great to talk to you.
Now, the conference was a staple for 37 years, but it was canceled last year because of the pandemic. And there are still some concerns about the pandemic, obviously. So how was this year's conference different?
Yeah, it really is an amazing collection of people, like 200 or 300 billionaires, top executives, folks from media and tech. So you have all these folks in one place, and that's bound to cause some concern. So this year, upon arrival, everyone had to prove that he or she has been tested upon walking into the lodge. And then there was a COVID test, a rapid COVID test. They made sure all of that was taken care of, and then the masks came off. I will say what was kind of remarkable, I've covered this event in the past, is what makes it feel kind of summer campy is Allen & Company has opened the door for executives to come with their families. And there's almost like a parallel conference, parallel programming for kids of these executives with activities at the pool, hiking trips of their own. All of that was off this year in the interests of health safety. So it was a smaller conference in that sense this year, and by result of that, a bit less lively than it used to be in the past.
Well, since some of us, at least listening to this, are not billionaires, can you describe what it's like for attendees at this conference, which is fully paid for by Allen & Company?
Yeah, this private bank picks up the whole tab, as you mentioned. They pay for accommodations and food and entertainment. And it takes place in this beautiful resort town, which is pretty remote in Idaho, in Sun Valley. And they take over essentially the whole resort. So you see these executives and billionaires walking around, going to programming in the morning. They have panel discussions and Q&As. Often high-level government officials come in, both from the U.S. and abroad. So there's a lot of programming, but what Allen & Co. tries to create is a sort of safe and comfortable environment for all of these influential people to talk with one another. So there might be chats at this duck pond, which is near the Sun Valley Inn. There might be hikes or rafting trips or bike rides where executives who know each other can reconnect. Those who don't know each other can get to know each other better. And the calculation this bank is making is by paying for all of this, by creating this good mood and good attitude among all of these executives, that maybe a deal will arise in the future. If that's the case, Allen & Company would benefit. They'd be able to get a cut of whatever the transaction is, whatever the cost is. So it is a business decision, but it is a low-pressure feel to the conference for most of it, Don.
You had Apple CEO Tim Cook there, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos of Amazon. Who else was there?
Yeah, it started as a media and tech conference. It's really grown since then to encompass the automotive industry. Mary Barra was there from GM, entertainment. So you had Bob Iger, formerly of Disney, Brian Grazer, who's with Imagine. So all of them are together. I talked with Joey Levin, who's the head of IAC. That's a holding company that does a lot of media deals. And I asked him why it was so important to have everybody back in one place this year. Here's what he said.
When you set up a meeting with an agenda, you know, that adds a level of formality to it that isn't always necessary. When you can come to a place and just sit down with people who you know a little bit, or you're looking to get to know each other and things like that, and have that informality to it, it's a fantastic thing. I think it's that sort of serendipity is great for business and fun. You know, it's nice to see people.
We need to leave it there. NPR's David Gura, thank you.
It's marching season in Northern Ireland. The annual event highlights the religious and political divisions in this small country that's part of the United Kingdom and separate from the Republic of Ireland to the south. NPR's Frank Langfitt joins us now from Belfast. And Frank, first of all, what are these Protestant marches? What do they commemorate?
They celebrate officially the victory of Protestant King William of Orange over Catholic King James II in 1690. But really, this is an expression of Protestant nationalism and pride in a city that's really still very divided. I'm in a loyalist Protestant neighborhood, very loyal to the United Kingdom, and it's full of Union flags and sort of very patriotic feel here.
Yeah, when you say Protestant nationalism and pride, I wonder if some of the events are actually designed to provoke a response from the Catholics.
Well, you know, the marches are much better now. They've been rerouted over the years away from Catholic pro-Republic of Ireland neighborhoods. But the one thing that the Protestants do, some of them, is they hold big bonfires, more than 200 in the last few days. And I got to tell you, Peter, they're astounding. They're built of wooden pallets over 100 and around 147 feet high. And then last night outside my window, there was one that's about six stories high, and the sparks actually ended up lighting a structure near our hotel, and firemen had to come and put it out. But the biggest danger with these bonfires actually is really provoking people. Sometimes Protestant loyalists will put Irish flags on top, posters of officials with Sinn Féin, that's the political party of Irish republicanism. Sinn Féin wants Northern Ireland to be a part of the Irish Republic, and Sinn Féin officials certainly don't appreciate this, nor do lots of people who support them. This is a guy I talked to a couple days ago named John Finucane, and he's a member of the British Parliament with Sinn Féin.
If you celebrate your culture by having to burn an effigy of me or any of my party colleagues, or you have to wallpaper it with Irish flags, then I think we need to take a step back and identify that there's something seriously wrong with that.
I know you've been spending some time, as you just described, watching these parades over the last day or so. What does it feel like this year, though? Is there more tension?
It seems kind of somber this year. You know, Protestants used to run Northern Ireland, and they feel, a lot of them that I talk to feel they're losing power. And they're also increasingly cut off from the rest of the United Kingdom across the water. One of the big reasons, Peter, is Brexit. Now, Brexit created this internal customs border that separates Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. And many Protestant loyalists think that when it comes to this new border, that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he kind of sold them out. And recently I was talking with a guy named Ian Carlisle. He runs the Grand Orange Lodge. It's a Protestant fraternal organization. And here's how he put it.
At times it maybe feels like an unrequited love, that we're very much firm in our allegiance to the Crown. But yet we see successive British governments diminish our position within the United Kingdom. I think that we have almost a siege mentality now.
A siege mentality, that's interesting, Frank. You know, one of the concerns that was raised during Brexit and even after Brexit was that the peace that was secured by the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 would be in danger. And we saw just recently in April that there were riots in Northern Ireland. What are you watching for here as things progress?
Most people here don't think Northern Ireland is going to go back to the sort of mass violence that we saw during the Troubles. It was decades of killings between Protestants and Catholics. It cost about more than 3,600 lives. But there is a concern. You know, Sinn Féin wants to reunite Northern Ireland with the Irish Republic and is hoping to get a referendum in the next number of years. Now, hardcore Protestant loyalists that I've talked to, they're bitterly against it. There's a guy named Ian McLaughlin. He's a Protestant community worker.
I don't believe that this island will ever be reunited peacefully. The trajectory of peace in my opinion, has stalled.
Interesting, Frank. So what does that mean, do you think, for the future of
Northern
Ireland?
What I think it means is if there is an attempt at a poll here, a vote, to reunite with the island of Ireland, it's going to take tremendous political effort to make Protestant loyalists feel safe and comfortable because, you know, during the old days, there were a lot of civil rights violations and unfairness toward Irish Catholics here, and Protestants are worried that the same could be done to them. And if this is going to move forward and hold this province together, they're going to have to feel secure and know that there are benefits to them to actually joining the Irish Republic, a place that they fought against becoming a part of for decades.
Isn't there a sense, Frank, among younger people in Northern Ireland that they just want to put all of that behind them? They may not even fully, you know the history, that they just kind of want to move forward. Is there a sense
there
that
is, and I would say one thing that's really interesting, when you talk to a lot of people here, they're much more middle of the road. They don't really subscribe to this binary Catholic, Protestant, loyalist, Irish Republic, and, you know, division. And I think that they would love to see, you know, frankly, a better economy, more of what we call a peace dividend, and to move on with their lives. One thing I did notice in some of the marches I saw today, a lot of old men. And it was very interesting to me that I didn't see younger faces. And so I think there is generational change, but there's so much bitterness here, and it was so personal, and this is a small province, that it's going to take a lot of time for generations to move on from that old conflict.
NPR's Frank Langfitt reporting from Belfast. Thank you so much.
Great to talk, Peter.
We've been reporting on COVID-19 hotspots around the country. The Biden administration has offered to send surge response teams to help increase vaccination in those areas. Nevada's Democratic governor requested one for Las Vegas. Infections and hospitalizations there are on the rise, even as the number of people getting vaccinated has dropped sharply. Nevada Public Radio's Nate Hedgie reports.
It's been a busy morning for Las Vegas Lyft driver Guadalupe Serna. There's a volleyball tournament in town.
We have a lot of concerts. We have already opened for conventions.
Not to mention the thousands of tourists flying into Las Vegas every day to gamble.
It's a busy week right now.
But all those tourists are bringing more than just their money with them. Some are also carrying COVID-19, and it's rippling through the state. Nevada currently has one of the highest per capita infection rates in the country, but is at the bottom half of states for vaccination rates. Serna takes the virus seriously and is wearing a mask, but she also isn't vaccinated. She feels stuck between a rock and a hard place. She's afraid of the virus, but she's also afraid the vaccine might kill her.
Honestly, I'm really scared. Something happens after the vaccine, and that's one of the reasons I'm not vaccinated. I'm not doing it yet.
Health experts say the risk of a COVID infection far outweighs any from getting vaccinated. The new White House surge teams are trying to reach people like Serna by kicking off advertising campaigns, opening more vaccine clinics, and pumping in federal dollars and personnel. It's unclear when a team will begin work in Las Vegas. Brian Labus, a public health professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, says the feds face an uphill battle.
But that's really nothing new. We struggle quite a bit with our vaccination rates. Every single year we see the same issues with influenza, and we have not been able to solve it.
Labus says some minority communities' vaccine fears are rooted in historical mistreatment by medical professionals. Other folks think that COVID just isn't that big of a deal.
And if the federal government has some ideas that we haven't thought of or some ways to approach things and funding that can help us with that, it's definitely welcome to help us get our vaccination numbers to where we want them to be.
When they hear directly from doctors, that helps so much.
That's Joconda Arguello-Klein with Las Vegas's local culinary union. It represents about 60,000 frontline workers in Nevada's hospitality industry. Arguello-Klein says they've been trying to combat misinformation about the vaccine and welcomes more help from the federal government. The union hosts virtual town halls featuring doctors debunking myths and answering questions in both English and Spanish.
We have people in their language. They can make their questions. They can say, hey, I have this condition. Do you think I can take it? And they receive the right information. They can make the right choices.
Nevada's Democratic Governor Steve Sisolak has also tried a novel and very Las Vegas way of getting people vaccinated. In June, he launched a raffle giving out nearly 150 cash prizes to folks who get a first dose, but CDC numbers show it hasn't had a huge impact. Back in her car in Las Vegas, Guadalupe Serna says those big bucks won't convince her to get the shot.
It's not tempting enough for my health. I don't want to die. And to say an appointment, $1,000 or $10,000 or even $1,000,000 is not going to wake you up if you die.
For Serna, the money just won't help. But maybe a conversation with a doctor will. The Southern Nevada Health District says about 95% of those hospitalized for COVID-19 currently are unvaccinated. For NPR News, I'm Nate Hedgie in Las Vegas.
Two dramatic sports finals in London over the weekend. At Wimbledon, tennis legend Novak Djokovic cemented his place at the top with his 20th Grand Slam title, tying Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal for the number of Grand Slams won. Then, later that day, about an hour's drive south in Wembley Stadium, traffic notwithstanding, English soccer fans gathered for the European Championship final between England and Italy. It came down to a shootout and one last shot for England.
Bukayo Saka, one of the youngest players ever to play in the European Championship. He's got to score here to keep England alive. And he doesn't! And Italy are champions of Europe!
Oh, for more on these two exciting finishes, let's bring in Christopher Clary. He's been at Wimbledon covering it for the New York Times while keeping an eye on soccer or football as well. Christopher, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you. It was quite a weekend here, for sure.
Yeah. So let's start with that Euro Cup final. England's team was handpicked from some of the best players in the world. Italy didn't even qualify for the World Cup 3 years ago, and the last time they won the Euro Cup was in 1968. Just how exactly did Italy do it yesterday?
Well, Italy's been a very impressive side throughout this tournament, you know, rebuilt underneath their manager. They've been flashy, and they've also been clinical. And so I think everybody knew they were dangerous, but England was daring to dream. They talk about, you know, the Euro coming home, because that's where football or soccer was basically codified, was in this part of the world. It's become kind of a, I'd say, almost an ironic refrain for a long time. And they had not been this close in a major championship since 1966 when they won the World Cup. Wimbledon has certainly been on the back burner, and then it came down to penalties. And it's a brutal way to finish an important sporting event, but there it was. And you got a feel for that teenager.
Just so heartbreaking for England. For those who maybe don't know what extra time or shootouts mean, could you just describe the tension of those last couple of minutes as we all watch?
Well, the game last night, England scored in the first couple of minutes. Then it became excruciating. They had to wait and hold on to the lead. They lost the lead. So after if you're tied in a final or a championship game, you have to go to extra time. And it used to be a sudden death where one goal would do it, and they've changed that now. So you play two 15-minute periods. So you play 30 minutes more of soccer. And if it's still tied, then you go to penalty shootout, which is each team gets 5 penalty kicks. And it just becomes this moment where everybody watching knows that it's going to stay with the players their whole lives, good or bad.
Tennis. Wimbledon had wrapped up earlier in the day. Djokovic faced down the Italian Matteo Berrettini for Djokovic's third consecutive title at Wimbledon. Did Berrettini have a chance? I guess that was a tougher morning for the Italians. What are your highlights from that final match?
Well, Berrettini was a total newcomer to this level. He's never been in a Grand Slam final before. He reached the U.S. Open semifinals a couple of years ago. And Novak Djokovic, as you know, is one of the most accomplished players and experienced players in tennis history. And most important thing about this match was he was trying to tie Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, who've been his two career-long rivals, and win a 20th Grand Slam singles title, which is the men's record. He's been chasing them since he joined the tour. They've always been ahead of him, and anybody who knew his past and the game couldn't pick against him yesterday when he's playing Berrettini without any experience at that level. But Djokovic has weathered so many storms in his career, and he's on a great tear right now. He's has a chance to complete the Grand Slam, which hasn't been done since 1969, by winning all four major tournaments in the same calendar year. This was his third. And frankly, once he got through the first set after losing it and then won the first couple of games of the second set, he took control of that match. He's just so hard to get the ball past. He's such a great defender and so elastic.
In the women's singles final at Wimbledon, number one ranked Ashley Barty took the win in three sets. She dominated the former number one, Karolina Pliskova. What's the story there?
Looking at Ash Barty, I think it really has to be viewed through her home country's lens. I mean, she is a hugely popular figure in Australia. She's viewed as the quintessential Australian, humble, hardworking. She's Indigenous, and it was a real connection to the past. The last time an Australian woman had won the Wimbledon singles title was in 1980, Yvonne Goolagong-Colley, who also is an Indigenous woman. And they both have connected over the years, and Goolagong-Colley has been very much a mentor to Ash Barty. She put it together, and from what I was told, there were 2 million Australians watching in the middle of the night.
Hmm.
So that gives you an idea of sort of what weight she carries back there. And I think having a second Grand Slam singles title now, she won the French Open in 2019. She may hit a new level now heading into the Olympics and the U.S. Open.
Well, it was quite a day yesterday. My guess is your heart has slowed a bit. I hope you get a
I'm actually going off to cover
here.
The Open Golf for the New York Times, so it'll be the break will come in about a week. So we'll see how that goes. The country is slowly opening up over here, and they're going to have big crowds out for the golf, and that'll be it's been very heartening to see the crowds come back to sport over here. I know how much the country's been through.
Even though COVID's not done.
No, it's not, and that's a very good point.
That was Christopher Clary, international sports correspondent for the New York Times. Christopher, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I'm Don Gagne.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.